While you are getting comfortable and settling in, I will just welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this morning. And we are preparing to have the argument in our next case on the calendar, Craig David Halicki versus Commissioner of Public Safety, A211129. I will note that we are now mask optional, so please do whatever is comfortable for you. Before you leave, I would just ask that you remove those microphone covers that you just put on the microphones. Council, I know you're both familiar with our timing rules, but I'll cover them briefly since it may have been a while since you were actually here in the courtroom. Appellant will have 15 minutes to argue, respondent will have 15 minutes to argue, and then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Are you both ready to go? All right, then we will begin with counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Ramsey, and I represent the appellant, Craig Halicki, in this appeal. Mr. Halicki is appealing the district court order denying his motion for discovery of the source code. We are asking this court to overturn the trial court and order disclosure of the source code. Under Minnesota Supreme Court precedent, Mr. Halicki is entitled to the source code. The trial court erred on three grounds. One, when it ruled that it lacked jurisdiction to even hear the matter. Two, when it ruled that the state doesn't have possession, legal custody, or control of the source code. And three, it erred when it ruled that the source code, which controls nearly every single function of the breath test in this case, is not relevant to the validity, reliability, and accuracy of the breath test results. Curiously, the district court cited no appellate opinion in its order and certainly didn't cite to the seminal case of State v. Underdahl, the 2009 Supreme Court opinion.
It seems to me on that last point that Underdahl is really one of the cases that we need to focus in on in deciding whether, in fact, the district court abused its discretion by denying the requested discovery. And, you know, Underdahl 2, as I guess we call it, you know, had two people seeking the source code, Mr. Underdahl and I don't know if it was a Mr. or
Ms. Brunner, Your Honor.
Brunner. Yes. Why is this particular case, Mr. Halicki's case, closer to Brunner than it is Underdahl?
I agree. Underdahl is the seminal case, and we should focus on that. The Minnesota Supreme Court noted that Underdahl cited and brought forth no evidence demonstrating relevance. Zero. There were no submissions. But Brunner, on the other hand, had 9 submissions. None of them, by the way, were documents that specifically analyzed Mr. Brunner's case, and Mr. Brunner never was forced to claim that the results in his case were invalid, inaccurate, or unreliable. Instead, the Minnesota Supreme Court, under the Brunner portion, said that the standard requires 3 things. One, that of the materials that are submitted, must one define source code, what it is. And source code isn't complicated, that's just the human readable language of the software. So it's not complicated. 2, he must demonstrate a need for the source code. And we did that, and Brunner did that, by showing that analysis of the source code may reveal defects in the source code that could be used to challenge the validity, reliability, and accuracy. Not that it actually does. And then also list the potential problems that they might expect to find in review of the source code. And we did that here as well with live testimony. And we also submitted documents that were nearly identical to what Brunner submitted. We submitted the Chun case, for example, and the Supreme Court relied on that.
Did Brunner present the situation which exists in your case, and it seems to me is a hurdle, and that is a district court finding that the proffered expert was not, in fact, expert on the question of source codes, particular with source codes with respect to breath test.
No, it appears that no court analyzed until it got to the Supreme Court whether or not Brunner's showing was sufficient. From what I could find, only the Supreme Court said this is sufficient. But court since Underdahl, this court, in probably almost two dozen cases, has analyzed that. And in every single case, let me just go through it here. There are about 17 post-Underdahl cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court, or by this Court of Appeals, rather. In 12 of those cases, this court found, by my count, that the trial court abused its discretion by not granting source code, where the driver at least made a minimal lenient showing is the word that's used by the Supreme Court and this court. And in none of those cases did they have, that I could find, did they have live testimony that we had here. But not only did we have live testimony, we submitted a transcript of Professor Stoltz, and along with those other documents that do the three things. Even if you take away Professor Stoltz, which I think there was an abuse of discretion there, but even if we do, we still meet the minimum threshold. We have documents that describe or define what source code is, that talk about what are some of the defects we may be able to find with source code analysis, and we're able to show that analysis of the source code may reveal defects that can be used to challenge the validity and reliability. This court has said, in the Duncan case and others, and it's Duncan versus Commissioner, 2009 Westlaw, 2866280, that the driver does, or that the standard does not require that there be a preliminary showing by some other means that the test is invalid, unreliable, or inaccurate. So the commissioner is going to get up here and say, look, Ramsey never brought any evidence showing that something's wrong with this test. That is not the standard. And no driver who has ever been granted source code has been ever been able to show that, at least in the cases that have been brought before this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court.
What was the evidence here that challenged or made relevant the source code as to your client's particular test? What was it about his particular test that raises the issue of reliability of the Data Master?
And first of all, I think it's a red herring. We don't have to show that. Brunner, as Your Honor mentioned, never showed that. He didn't have any experts analyze his test. So I don't think we should be required to do it here.
So you're arguing that part of Underdahl 2 overrules, or maybe implicitly overrules, this court's decision in Abbott that said you do have to have some showing with respect to the driver's individual test?
Yes, Underdahl came after Abbott, right? And so I think that part of Abbott has been overruled by Underdahl. Abbott says two things, right? That the standard is relevance, and if it's not relevance, then you need to show, I forget the other
good
part.
Cause.
Good cause, yeah. And I'm not trying to show good cause here because I think we meet the relevance prong under Underdahl.
So just so that I'm clear, so relevance is simply that a data master was used and a result was obtained? What are the facts that make it relevant?
Yeah, so the standard, Your Honor, is that what the court is, Your Honor, is asking?
I'm just wondering, in this case, how are you showing relevance to the case,
yeah,
to your case?
So what the testimony shows is this, is that my client submitted to a breath test on the Data Master, that the Data Master is essentially a computer, and nearly every single aspect of that test is run by that computer program. And if you take away the computer program, you have an oversized paperweight. The machine can't function without it. It determines the observation period, the wait time for the observation period that the driver, that the operator has to enter into. It determines those preliminary checks, the self-checks it goes through. It does all of that. The computer program runs all of that. It determines acceptance criteria, whether a sufficient amount of air was blown, whether it meets the acceptance criteria without getting more complicated than that. It determines, as Professor Stoltz said, interfering substances on a person's breath that may artificially add or erroneously add to the reading. It actually determines the measurement of the sample and then also the reporting. So it handles every single aspect of a breath test result.
And that's true in every breath test.
It is.
So then it seems to me that puts us squarely into the question of whether this issue should come up before this court in the first instance as a challenge to the general reliability of this test, or whether it was appropriately raised in a revocation proceeding on behalf of an individual. That's what I'm struggling with.
Yeah, well, I have an answer for that, so you don't have to struggle any longer, Your Honor. The Minnesota Supreme Court also addressed that issue, that very issue, in Underdahl 1, which was the case entitled In Re Underdahl. This is the 2007 case, 735 Northwest 2nd at 706. Squarely on point, excuse me. In that case, the Attorney General, as here, argued that the driver should have brought that issue before the Court of Appeals, challenging the administrative review-making process. The Minnesota Supreme Court said no. Under Minnesota Statute 169A.52 or 53, a district court has jurisdiction over this very issue because it goes to whether the test result is valid, reliable, and accurate. That is directly on point from the Minnesota Supreme Court. Curiously, the district court in this case didn't address Underdahl 1, didn't even mention it. In fact, in the district court's memorandum, it contains no citation to any case law whatsoever. Having addressed jurisdiction and relevance, I will now move on to possession, custody, and control. And as I do that, I'll note here that in this case that Mr. Hulicki went through, where he was charged criminally and also lost his license, so we had two cases that were proceeding in parallel. In the criminal case, we brought the same motion with the same exhibits, but we didn't present live testimony. In that case, the trial court granted my motion for discovery. We've attached that memorandum to my, that order and memorandum to my case law. In that case, the trial court lays out the case law perfectly, addresses Underdahl 1, saying this is the jurisdictional issue. The Supreme Court said there's jurisdiction. Underdahl 2, which lays out the standard. What is source code, why there's a need for it, and what we're looking for. And he granted it. He went on further to say why the state has possession, custody, and legal control over it. He pointed out that, all of you may remember the first round of source code, where we literally had to go to federal court to get it. We, as a state, wanted to learn from that. And I thought we did at the time. So we, as a state, got a contract. Well, first of all, we put out an RFP that said, we don't want to go through this again, so if you're going to sell us your machine, you have to agree to turn over the source code. That's right in the RFP. And then we did a contract, 2010, with National Patent Analytical Systems. And in that contract and with the RFP, there's ample evidence showing that even today, the state may not have physical control over the source code. It definitely has legal custody and control over it contractually.
So, Mr. Ramsey, you have the discovery. How does that not moot out the case before us now, if you have it, if you have the source code?
I don't have the source code.
Okay. I thought you said that the district court granted your discovery motion.
It did.
In the criminal case.
Did.
Okay.
But the state didn't turn it over.
Got it.
Instead, they dismissed the DWI charges.
I see. Okay, thank you for clarifying that.
And that's happened in other cases. We included other district court opinions in our memorandum. Contrary to what this judge said in this case, we haven't been losing every single case. The commissioner has been winning a disproportionate amount of them, but that's not what this court should rule upon, what district courts are doing.
Have you ever attempted to subpoena the information from the third party, the source code information?
I have, Your Honor. It's important to note that National Patent, in an email, and I think the court has seen that, said from the president, told the attorney general, look, I checked with our employees and we don't seem to have it. That's what the commissioner is relying on to say that it doesn't have or can't get legal custody or control over it, an email. I have tried. I've requested it. And National Patent claims that they don't have it. Talk to Intoximeters, they're playing keep away. I have asked Intoximeters for it, and they said it's been the standards that they have been changing. Initially, they said, if you send us $250 and sign an NDA, we will send you the CD. Great. I'll have my expert sign an NDA. We'll send you a check. We'll review the CD. We'll have it done in 30 days, and we'll put this to bed forever. They didn't want to do that. Intoximeters isn't even registered to, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you have gone over your time. If you want to just finish your thought, you may do so, though.
They won't turn it over. They're not registered to do business in Minnesota. They're not registered with the Secretary of the State. And Missouri is not even, hasn't even adopted the Uniform Discovery Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey. And of course, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Nicholas Moen. I'm here on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety to ask this court to sustain the order of the district court. The district court denied appellant's discovery motion on three alternative and independent basis: that the discovery was not relevant, that it was not in the possession, custody, and control of the respondent, and that there was not jurisdiction to hear the issue.
Mr. Moen, what do you feel is your strongest argument in favor of affirmance?
Well, Your Honor, I think the strongest argument would be relevance. And you asked about the Underdahl-Brunner case, and I don't think that is the standard, Your Honor. I believe that this court should be looking at its own recent decision in Curran and at Abbott. Underdahl was a criminal case. Abbott was a civil case. Curran is a civil case. And at the time of the previous source code litigation, the discovery standard in criminal and civil cases was basically the same thing. So Underdahl was persuasive at that point in time. The discovery standard has changed since the previous round of source code litigation. We now have 2602B. In civil discovery matters, and
but why isn't the request for the source code proportional and relevant and within the bounds of the new Rule 26 when a particular party makes the showing that it's relevant to his or her claim or defense?
Well, if a party made a showing that it was relevant, then it would be relevant. But that has not happened here, and 2602B requires that the discovery be relevant to any party's claim or defense, proportional to the needs of the case, and the court needs to analyze the importance of the discovery in resolving the issues.
Well, it seems to me, if you pass relevance, why wouldn't the source code, which controls how this test plays out from start to finish, why wouldn't the request for that be proportional and be important and significant in the case if you get past the relevance hurdle?
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't think that the appellant has gotten past the relevance hurdle.
No, I appreciate that. I'm just saying I'm having a hard time understanding your argument that the changes to Rule 26, which really say even if discovery sought is relevant, it may be limited if it's not proportional to the needs of the case. I'm just trying to figure out how that change to the rule really changes our analysis of whether, in this case, Mr. Halicki has made the showing that this source code's relevant.
Proportionality is an independent and separate basis for overturning the discovery. We did argue that. That was not ruled on by the district court. I do think, though, that the provision about the importance of the discovery in resolving the issues in 2602B ties into relevance under 2602B and ties also directly into appellant's complete inability to show anything specific to its test. And this
is that the reason why you're claiming that it's not relevant, because the appellant has not been able to show that the source code would demonstrate that his particular test is unreliable?
It's a primary reason, not the only one, Your Honor. As this court well knows, a discovery determination needs to be made on the submissions of both parties. And after considering the submissions of both parties, the district court determined it was not relevant. And in Curran, this court only a few months ago said that because the evidence relied upon by Curran was not specific to him or his test result, he did not meet his burden, and therefore the court did not.
And how is a petitioner ever going to demonstrate that the source code could undermine the reliability of the test if they can't get the source code? I mean, I feel like we're on a hamster wheel here.
Well, Your Honor, that assumes that there would be an error in the source code affecting the accuracy and reliability of the test result.
So why not give it to them?
Well, it assumes an error that affects the accuracy and reliability and is not in any way manifest on the test record or caught by any of the fail-safes or preliminary measures.
And right, and wouldn't the production of the source code reveal that information?
It could, Your Honor.
And so why don't you give it to them?
Well, it's not relevant, first of all. And secondly, it is not in the possession, custody, and control of the state of Minnesota, as determined by this district court. Mr. Ramsey talked about the contract he was primarily talking about was the contract with National Patent Analytical Systems. That contract is expired, and any right, hypothetical right to the source code through that contract would come through National Patent Analytical Systems, and their president, in an email communication, which was submitted to the district court in this case, states that they do not have the source code, nor do they have a way to get it. The current
somebody's got it. I mean, we have purchased all of these pieces of equipment that contain a source code, and there's contracts that at least go back to the originator of that equipment. You would assume that somebody has it.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And do you know who has it?
Intoximeters has the source code, and under their contract, which was also in the record in the district court files here, it is Exhibit A. In our filings, which were filed as index number 21 through 22 combined, paragraph 13 talks about possession of the source code, and it states explicitly.
So there's no relationship between the state and Intoximeters who has the source code. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct, Your Honor. Paragraph 13 of the current contract with Intoximeters makes it abundantly clear that the sole party with control and custody of the source code is Intoximeters. There is a pathway to get the source code through the contract, which appellant has not exercised. And
would you stand in the way of a petitioner asking for the source code if they followed the correct procedure?
That would have nothing to do with the state of Minnesota, Your Honor, if they are trying to get it through Intoximeters. They're trying to go through the back door and have the district court order the state to do their civil discovery work for them.
As I understand it, in Underdahl 1, from 07, in that case, the state conceded, or the commissioner conceded, that they in fact had custody and control of the intoxilizer source code, right?
There was a concession that they had some access to it.
Okay.
Yes, Your
Honor. So that is different. I'd still like to take you back to Underdahl 2, I guess, and explain to me why this case is more like Mr. Underdahl, in which case I think the Supreme Court reversed and said you don't get the discovery, as opposed to Mr. Brunner, who the Supreme Court affirmed the district court, I guess, ordering the discovery. Why is this case more like Brunner?
Well, Your Honor, Brunner was the one who had the source code granted. Underdahl was the one.
No, right. And so the Supreme Court affirmed the district court in providing that in ordering the discovery in Brunner. But why is this case more like Brunner in terms of the showing made to obtain the source code than Underdahl?
Your Honor, I would say that this case is not in any way like Brunner. Appellant noted that they have submitted several of the same documents which were submitted in Brunner. However, the submissions of respondent are entirely different, as they should be, because this is an entirely different instrument, and it is more than 10 years later. The submissions should be different. The fact that many of the submissions are the same go again to their lack of relevance. Getting back to the contract, I would like to note that the district court, as appellant said, they did make an effort, I don't believe in this case, but in other cases, to obtain the source code from intoximeters. The district court, in its order, noted that in 2018, intoximeters informed the counsel for appellant in this case that his purported expert, Dr. Stoltz, was not a qualified breath testing expert to analyze the source code, which was one of their requirements for disclosure. And as the district court noted in its order, nothing by appellant's counsel has been done since then to rectify that defect.
Counsel, what about just jumping back to the relevance, just trying to wrap my head around what that would mean. Could a district court look at the factual circumstances of a case in making that determination? For example, in this case, the alcohol concentration was measured right at that legal limit. Is that a circumstance that could make the source code relevant?
Your Honor, I don't think that... I understand the appeal of the idea that if the number is close to the threshold, it could be more relevant than if the number is really high. But I think that the actual breath alcohol concentration is independent from relevance. The relevance is based on the submissions about from the parties, which were independent from the concentration. I think regardless of the concentration, the source code is not relevant in this case based on the submissions of the parties and the testimony, which, as this court noted, the district court found Dr. Stoltz not a credible witness based on the fact that his work does not include breath testing, the DMT, writing source code, or reviewing source code for breath testing instruments, as stated in pages 62 through 64, I believe, of the transcript.
So what would we need to, in your mind, say that this particular request to access the source code is relevant in a particular case? I think you've suggested you'd need a qualified expert to say so. What else would you need? What other showing would someone in Mr. Hulicki's position need to make?
Your Honor, I can't speculate as to what evidence would be needed for a district court to find a determination of relevance. All I can say is that based on the submissions of the parties in this case and the testimony, that the district court correctly determined that the source code was not relevant.
And are we on the same hamster wheel with respect to qualifying an expert? Because the reason that Intoximeters isn't disclosing the source code to this particular expert is because they've deemed him unqualified to examine the source code because he's never examined the source code before. So is that the same problem that we have?
I shouldn't speculate as to why Intoximeters made that determination. I wasn't party to that. But the district court's determination that he was not an expert was not based upon the fact that he hasn't examined the source code, but the fact that he studies rare isotopes. He does not work in the field of breath testing. He does not work with the DMT. He does not write breath testing source code. He does not review breath testing source code. He is somehow testifying about it as a purported expert, but the actual scientific field he works in has nothing to do with it and is entirely unrelated. And that is why the district court made the determination that it did, that Dr. Stoltz was not a qualified expert. And to go back to your point, Your Honor, I don't think necessarily a qualified expert is required for a finding of relevance, but the fact that the expert here was found not to be credible and not qualified definitely bolsters the district court's determination and goes to the fact that it was not an abuse of discretion in this case. I will touch, I guess that's all I have at this point, Your Honors. If you have any further questions, I would be happy to answer them. If not, I will just ask that the court uphold the ruling of the district court, and I would request a precedential opinion in this case, as this is a very similar, almost factually identical to Curran, and on very short, very recent time frame to that case.
And what rule of law would you have us announce if we were to issue a precedential opinion?
Well, I think the novelty comes, Your Honor, from the fact that while there are previous cases regarding source code litigation, none of them, other than Curran, involve the DMT, and none of the cases that appellant cites to, those 17 cases, none of them involve the current rule of civil discovery, which is 26.02B, which, again, this court cited to in full in Curran. And that would be the basis in the respondent's opinion. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Rohn. Back to you, Mr. Ramsey.
Thank you, Your Honor. So it's clear that the commissioner wants this court to enunciate a new rule of law instead of just following Underdahl 2, and I would ask that the court reject that suggestion. On the issue of what is a qualified expert, Professor Stoltz is an assistant professor of at the University of Michigan State. He runs their National Cyclotron Laboratory. He said that his expertise lies in data acquisition and analysis and writing software to accomplish that, which he says is identical, the identical process to what we have here. It was an abuse of discretion for this court, sorry, the trial court, to find that Stoltz was not an expert on the issue of source code. All we have to do is look at Rule 702 to determine what an expert is. That's a person who has specialized training, expertise, or knowledge that can help a finder of fact. It is absurd to say that that professor who has that kind of training and expertise in source code writing, which he does every day in his testimony, that deals with data acquisition and analysis, isn't qualified to address source code of a breath test machine. Furthermore, this court said in State v. Bunker, while we question the evidentiary value of the unsworn Thomas Burr letter, a forensic scientist, if an affidavit relating to source codes in voting machines from a professor is sufficient to satisfy Rule 9, we are hard-pressed to say that an affidavit from a professor that discusses source codes in an actual intoxilizer does not. This court recognized that the Supreme Court found in a case or in a filing where the driver didn't even submit an actual attack on that machine, instead used analysis of a source code of voting machines is sufficient. This court certainly could find that we met that burden here, where we have filed similar affidavits and documents. With respect to the new rule dealing with proportionality, I think that's an absurd argument to say that that rule changes the legal landscape of the standard here. First of all, the burden is on the opponent to the source code to demonstrate why it's disproportionate. The parties here expected source code discovery. They put it in their contract. It's replete with those provisions. Even if there's a disagreement, they expected to be ordered to turn it over. And so to say now that it's disproportionate, that we never expected this is unfair, that's baloney. It's in the contract. Of course the parties expected it. I agree with this court in the Bunker case. If the materials in Brunner were sufficient to meet the Supreme Court standard, it should be sufficient to meet the district court standard as well.
Don't we have to view that, though, Brunner, through the the standard of review lens that the Supreme Court was using? I mean, it was whether the district court abused its discretion in ordering the discovery. I mean, that was the issue before the Supreme Court. I mean, here we have the opposite. We are looking at abuse of discretion, claimed abuse of discretion of a district court order saying, nope, this discovery is not appropriate or not warranted.
I agree. And this court has said in more than a dozen cases that that is the standard, where we don't need to show that. Just look at the Duncan case that I've already cited to. It's such a minimal, lenient threshold.
So let me just be clear. So you're saying the district court abused its discretion, yes, because it applied the wrong standard.
Yes.
Or a standard that was not warranted by the case law.
Correct. Oh. Underdahl 2 is the standard, and I really don't know what standard the trial court used. Again, it cited no case law in its memorandum. And certainly on the jurisdictional issue, black letter law from our state Supreme Court ignored by this district court. That's a de novo standard, of course, and that clearly should be overturned. On the issue of whether or not discovery should be granted, we have to look at what standard it used, and if it used the wrong standard, that's a de novo review as well. I appreciate the time and your patience here today. We'd ask that the court overturn the trial court and grant Mr. Halicki's motion for discovery. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today.